to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Zander Keg, licensed social worker. Joining us this hour are two guests, and Zander will do the intros of both guests this hour.
Thank you, Ahn. Yes, we definitely have two wonderful guests on today. I'm really looking forward to this show and having you hear about the amazing work that they're doing. The first guest is Aaron Kimberly. Aaron describes himself as a transsexual man, born female with a rare ovotesticular intersex condition. He's worked as a mental health nurse since 2008 in hospital and community settings. In 2001, he co-founded the Gender Dysphoria Alliance to educate about different types of gender dysphoria from an evidence-based, without the lens of political ideology. He's also the co-host of the Transparency Podcast. Welcome to the show, Aaron Kimberly.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this conversation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I just want to clear up. It's 2001. That's what's typed up. It's not 2021.
That's okay. A typo. 2021.
Thank you. Okay. I wanted to make sure. So in 2021, you founded Gender Dysphoria Alliance, or GDA. We may refer to it during the rest of the show. And then our second guest is Aaron Terrell. So we have two Aarons with us today. So we're going to be differentiating with Aaron K and Aaron T going forward. So this is Aaron Terrell, or Aaron T. Aaron is a 39-year-old trans man from Washington State. He transitioned in 2012, which relieved his gender dysphoria immensely. He assumed all trans people had the same experience of gender dysphoria and that one solution was physical transition, including for children. However, in 2017, he became aware that young women were physically transitioning, not to relieve dysphoria, but to demonstrate that they belong to the social category of trans. Oh, I can't wait to get into that. While researching this new social phenomenon, he became aware of the growing number of detransitioners, some of whom even had a similar experience of gender dysphoria he did. He eventually concluded that transgenderism and even gender dysphoria are not one thing, and medicalizing them as though they were is having devastating impacts, especially for children and their families who were sent on that path. Because Aaron has no clinical credentials and his day job is in an unrelated field, the way he feels he can best make a difference is by sharing his own experience as openly and honestly as possible in an attempt to clear away some of the confusion and obscurantism. Oof. Okay. Oof. I'm tongue-tied on that one. That surrounds this issue. Aaron says when he isn't at work or oversharing on the Transparency Podcast, which is the podcast for the Gender Dysphoria Alliance, he's probably camping with his partner at a home, spoiling his aging Chiweenie. Love those dogs. So welcome, Aaron Terrell, to the show.
Thank you very much for having me and having us. Yeah, Aaron Kay said, I'm very glad to be here. Looking forward to the conversation. Sorry about the long intro there, then throwing in the collegiate. I stumbled upon that word, I think, a couple of years ago, and I was like, this is the most perfect description of what's going on with this issue, is like intentionally obscuring. Anyway, I'll stop now. But yeah.
No, thank you. I was going really to ask you to define it, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, a concerted effort to obscure something.
Aaron Kay, let me start with you, because when you're describing the Gender Dysphoria Alliance, and one of the reasons for founding it was because of wanting to dive into evidence-based information about gender dysphoria. And with Aaron T, you talked about how you differentiate between gender dysphoria and transgenderism, right? And so I would imagine that that's part of this issue of seeking evidence-based information, studies done using the scientific method. Why do you think an evidence-based understanding of transness and gender dysphoria is missing, and why you think it's important in the dialogue, transness and gender dysphoria?
My primary concern is the young people and what we're seeing with so many young people, especially teen girls. There's different ways of describing it. I mean, some would describe it as ROGD, some would say social contagion, some say trans trenders. But there's so many of these young teen girls who seem to be caught up in a youth subculture and medicalizing in order to fit into a subculture. And we really can't protect these vulnerable young people unless we have a firm grasp on what gender dysphoria is in the first place. That's my primary concern, is protecting these young people. I got into a little bit of gender medicine in my own clinical practice and was in a position of meeting many of these young people a lot of them have very complex presentations, very, you know, layers of different diagnoses. And I could just sense, I mean, it's not measurable. Gender dysphoria itself isn't measurable. It's not like we can do a blood test to sort out who's who and who's going to benefit from these treatments. I mean, I do feel, as I have, as Aaron T has said, I mean, I do feel like I've benefited from these treatments in some way, but it's still, even for those of us who I think it's an appropriate intervention, it's still a complicated process. It's socially complicated. It's medically complicated. It's psychologically complicated, and not to be taken lightly. And so many of these kids would kind of skip in through our doors gleefully, sometimes in groups, little peer groups, and we're excited at the prospect of being trans. And that seems like a very different motivation than what I was seeing in, at least with FTMs. I mean, that was my peer group, was former lesbian FTMs. Just a very different, I don't know how to describe it. Just a very different energy comes in the room with these young people. And they seem to be, there's an intention to disrupt. Whereas I think with the old school transsexuals, our intention wasn't to disrupt society. Our intention was to feel okay in our skin and to integrate into society as transsexuals to the best of our ability. And that's not what I still see that in some of these youth. And those youth were saying, I want nothing to do with the trans community. I don't want to join your groups. I don't want to meet any other trans people. Just give me the hormones and I'm going to get on with my life. But there's some where the motivation very much seems to be fitting into a group. And I don't think medicalizing all of these kids who are coming in with all kinds of different things and concerns and problems and motivations. And we have to ground this in something. And so I feel like grounding it in the reality of what is gender dysphoria, I think is where we need to land at some point in order to protect the kids that don't have gender dysphoria and figure out what is going on for them and getting to know them and understand them.
Landing, or perhaps the starting place, right? Also, for the listeners, I want to just cover a couple of initialisms that were used. So ROGD, rapid onset gender dysphoria. This is considered to be a very controversial way to describe a whole cohort of young teen girls primarily that have been presenting to gender clinics around the Western world for the last few years. What is less contentious is adult onset gender dysphoria, but this is basically describing the same group of patients or clients that are appearing in these clinics, but one has been problematized and one has not. But I don't believe there's any denial or rejection that there is a significant uptick, 4,000 to 5,000% in this adolescent, primarily natal girls or biological females who are presenting. Aaron K mentioned, you know, use the word old school transsexual. And so another initialism is FTM, which is less familiar to people these days, especially in our international audience of listeners. Female to male. There's also MTF, male to female. These are shorthand ways that we use to communicate within our community and about ourselves. They were in the literature. So if you're doing research on the community going back, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, you'll see FTM and MTF used a lot. My understanding is that we used to be called, for example, somebody like us, like the two Aarons and I, we as trans men, we would have been referred to pre-female to male as female transsexuals. And then Lewis Graydon Sullivan, or Lou Sullivan, a gay trans man in the San Francisco Bay Area in the late 80s and early 90s, was successful in arguing among the American Psychiatric Association members that we should be called male transsexuals. And I don't think he was specifically meaning we're switching our chromosomal or natal or biological sex, but we're going from like a female sex role to a male sex role. That's my understanding of that term. So just to give everybody a little bit of a vocabulary and history lesson there. Aaron T., is there anything else you want to say about why you think it's important to have evidence-based underpinning to gender dysphoria and being trans or trans medicine in particular?
Yeah. I really think it's kind of baffling to me that, like, reading what Hannah Barnes was reporting out of her investigation into the Tavistock Gender Clinic, that even the clinicians, the directors of these clinics don't even know what it is they're treating. Or a lot of the people, you know, in the clinical staff are in disagreement about what it is they are treating. So even just the case of having an establishment of what even is, what are we prescribing medication to fix. Like, if we don't even know that, understanding what gender dysphoria is, where it comes from, that should be the absolute foundation before any prescriptions are being written or surgeries referred for. And then the other thing is just with the different types of gender dysphoria, you're gonna see different outcomes from transition. I'm not sure if how we want to get in the weeds of the different types of gender dysphoria that we're kind of aware of currently. For some of those, if they didn't understand what it was that was causing them to desire transition in the first place, they could end up having severe regret about actually transitioning. And it just seems very, very negligent to be providing these irreversible treatments to somebody without even telling them, without any provider or the patient knowing what the cause of this gender distress is.
Is there a simple or brief way to nutshell what the different types of gender dysphoria are from your studies, the people that you've talked to, the books you've read? Is there a way to do that, like an encapsulation of that?
There isn't for females, it seems like. We're much more complicated and abstract and diverse in our motivations but the male gender dysphoria is pretty well understood. It's controversial right now, but you see two very distinct different pathways to gender dysphoria. One is what most people kind of think of when they think of a transgender people, which is highly effeminate gay males who just are just so feminine. They almost, you kind of understand where that term born in the wrong body came from. It's like, it just doesn't, like, they're just so feminine. It makes more sense. I don't want to make a judgment call there, but it's just like, you totally understand where that phrase came from with them. And then there's another cohort that's completely different. And that is they're typically just averagely masculine males, but they have this interesting kind of turn of sexuality that makes them attracted to the idea of being female, kind of like a desire to be that which they are attracted to. It's quite a controversial theory. It's called autogynephilia. It is the most common type of dysphoria in males, accounting for at least 75% of male to female transitioners. Again, it's hotly contested because a lot of trans activists feel like that of trans people. And I can see why that is, but I think, if we're making these medical decisions, people need to know what their motivation is and where these feelings are coming from. So I'm sorry, I think medicine needs to trump PR personally.
Now, I'm familiar with autogynephilia, a term that I'm less familiar with, but I recently met somebody, not in person, but via, digitally or virtually, I met up with them. They've written a book called Auto-Heterosexuality. We're going to actually have them on the show next month. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. The thing about auto-heterosexuality that I find really interesting, and I'm wondering if any of you know about this, there's a book called Gender Queer. It's a graphic novel, and it's been making the news over the last, few months, maybe the last year, because it's being found in public school libraries at maybe the middle school level. And so it's this graphic novel called Gender Queer. And people are like, well, what's the problem with that? Why do you have an issue with it? And besides the fact that it has like graphic depictions of oral sex in the book, at the very end of it, I just heard about this recently. At the end of the book, the main character discovers that what they really are, what their true identity is auto-heterosexual. And I haven't heard anybody from the community that it gets angry about autogynephilia being mentioned. They're not coming back around and saying anything about this auto-heterosexuality that's in this book called Gender Queer that they are probably championing a couple of days or weeks or months ago, because they were saying anybody who wants to get that book out of the library is a bigot. But now it contains a whole topic that they probably don't want to champion. So I think it's an interesting conundrum. I don't know if you're familiar with that issue coming up in that very specific book.
So I did not know that auto-heterosexuality is mentioned in that book. That's pretty interesting. It's kind of a novel concept. And the author of Auto-Heterosexuality, Phil Illy, who you're going to have on, incredible book. What he's trying to do is basically explain autogynephilia exactly as that auto-heterosexuality, which is a good way to understand it. It's auto meaning back at the self, but it's still heterosexuality because it's the opposite sex that you are attracted to. But he's also making the case that this exists in females as well as autoandrophilia. So also in females would be auto-heterosexual. Androphilia meaning male, gyna meaning female. That's what those sexology words are. But anyway, that is quite interesting because in genderqueer, the character is a female-to-male transitioner, correct?
Something either what we would call a natal sex, biological female, or a person assigned female at birth, right? It depends on who you're talking to. That's my understanding of it, yes. Until pretty recently, I'd say in the last few years, I had never met a trans woman or trans feminine or trans femme person who referred to themselves as genderqueer. I had only met people that come from our, quote, side of the community. So it doesn't surprise me that that character would be like that. Aaron, Kimberly, I'm wondering what you think about what makes us so much more complicated that we're not as easily pinned down. In my head, I'm thinking, ugh, women are so difficult. You know, it's like, yeah. What? Why do you think, have you heard from anybody about why they think it's so, there's such more diversity of identities or reasons that people transition that are biologically female?
It's a loaded question. I mean, I think it's been very understudied to start with. I mean, I think the researchers like Blanchard and Bailey, Blanchard was the one that coined the term autogynephilia, when they were doing the research back in the clinics in the early days, they said that there were far fewer females transitioning than there were males. And the only females that they were seeing at least in the adult cohort were butch lesbians. And so they kind of felt like, okay, we have our head wrapped around this already. And I think they made the assumption that anything that they understood about homosexual transsexuals in males could just be laid over the butch lesbians. And I think one of the things that Aaron, Terrell, and I are exploring in our podcast is that there's probably diversity within even what we call a butch lesbian. And one of the really highly contested thoughts that comes out of Phil Illy's book is how many of these butch lesbians have something similar to autogynephilia, which would be autoandrophilia. And could that in part or in whole in its entirety explain some butch lesbianism? The sexologists don't believe that females have paraphilias, or at least they're very rare. But I think, you know, the hypothesis that Phil presents, and I know Aaron T is really, you know, behind this hypothesis, that AGP is, the way I like to describe it, it's heterosexuality turned inside out. And it's been classed as a paraphilia as a target location error, that your target of attraction is misplaced. But I think it's possible that the mechanism for a sexuality being inverted onto self could be a completely separate mechanism. And so the hypothesis is, could that mechanism be autism, given the very high correlation between AGP and autism?
I don't know how they can say that it's rare in the female population, just because there haven't been studies done. Not enough.
Yeah, I'd really like to see it studied, because I do think there's a lot going on. Even like I said, even if it was all just the butch lesbians, quote unquote, I think there's more that needs to be investigated, because I don't think all butch lesbians are just a monolith either. But now we're not even just seeing butch lesbians, we're seeing heterosexual women transition, you know. So I think there's so many different motivations. We know that females are more likely to be caught up in social contagions. Females are more likely to be sexually assaulted. So sexual trauma could be a factor for some girls and women transitioning. So I just think there's so many uninvestigated layers and question marks, and we're really not serving the females very well if we don't really understand what's going on and what the motivations are.
We are going to take our first commercial break. We will be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Good, good. We are back from our first commercial break. Let's pick up where we last left off.
It's just another example of how we've been left out of medical research. Right? This is not a new complaint that has been that has been levied against medical science, that's for sure. Yeah. One of the things I wanted to talk to you both about is activism, right? An activism culture. And I'd love to hear maybe something about your role in activism or maybe advocacy. Like, I don't refer to myself as an activist. I refer myself as an advocate, but I have been an activist, you know, in my life. So maybe you have a similar background. But I'm curious what you think about how it's changed over the years, because you're sort of, with Gender Dysphoria Alliance, you're finding yourself right in the crosshairs of advocacy and activism, and you've probably been around the world long enough to know what activism and advocacy can do to advance social movements, right? Cultural movements. So it's not that it's necessarily a negative thing, but there have been maybe not changes, but maybe other forms of activism that were used in other movements that have come into our movement that are perhaps based on queer theory and how that changes things. So I don't know if there's something you'd like to say about cultural shifts and advocacy and activism.
Yeah, there's sort of two parts of the current day activism that I wanted to comment on. One, you know, is the queer theory that you mentioned, which is where a lot of the thought comes from, which is meant to be disruptive and dismantle systems. But the other part of it is the flavor of the activism itself. So the means. So there's the thought, but there's also this very coercive tactic of intimidation that happens in current activism. You know, the cancel culture, the smearing people online, doxing people, trying to get people fired. That seems quite new. I mean, that when you hear people like Martin Luther King Jr., or we have a quote by Bell Hooks on our website where she's talking about social justice movements being based in an ethic of love. That's not what I'm seeing in modern day activism. It's a very angry, disruptive, abusive form of activism meant to force people into playing along with whatever it is you want to play along with. And it's a very authoritarian left-wing movement that's evolved over time. And when you pair those two things together, I think it's become very, very toxic. And I think it's done us a lot of harm because we, you know, for the first couple of decades, at least in gay and lesbian activism, and then the early days of trans activism, it was about that bridge building. It was about reassuring people that we weren't harmful, that we weren't out to get your kids. We weren't going to disrupt your societies. We weren't going to tear apart the fabric of society, that we wanted inclusion. We wanted to build bridges and be accepted in society and change hearts. And I feel a lot of that bridge building that was done is being dismantled by this very aggressive type of activism and these ideas that, meaning queer theory, these ideas that are meant to destabilize. And there's also a flavor of, like, here in Canada, our government launched a number of years ago a truth and reconciliation process for the First Nations people and the harms that were done by our government in the past. And I think that is the flavor of original social justice, was that idea of reconciliation, that we want healed hearts at the end of this. We want to love our neighbors, you know, and be accepted by our neighbors, whether we agree or disagree. We do live in a pluralistic society, but we still want to coexist with our neighbors in a peaceful, respectful way. Queer theory or you know, maybe critical theory more broadly never seems to want that resolution. They seem to want this constant punishment. It's like this historical harm or injustice that's been done to a group of people. We want you to pay for it and suffer for that indefinitely with no possibility of that reconciliation.
Oh boy. I like what you said about coexistence in a pluralistic society. Absolutely. Are you familiar with how in the 1990s, there was a movement of gay men and lesbian women, and probably some bisexual people as well, who attempted and then successfully were able to re-steer the course of the gay and lesbian rights movement away from the anti-military, anti-marriage, anti-church kind of sentiments within the gay and lesbian community. And they were able to pull it more towards the center and then march forward and then come out on top with getting same-sex marriage through the Supreme Court and also getting adoption in all 50 states for gay and lesbian couples and the ability to enlist and get a seek a commission in the U.S. military. So they were quite successful by pulling the narrative away from that part of our community. And I was talking with one of the individuals that was spearheading that movement back in those days. And he mentioned to me that there were people who were getting together to within the trans community to do a similar effort. And so I've plugged in with him and I'm going to let other people know about it once I get more information about it. But I don't think there's any time to waste at this point. I think you're right. I think that because of social media, those more destructive messages, right? You said dismantle, disrupt. That's the charge that comes, you know, from that part of the community. We've talked about this on other podcasts with other guests. And I mentioned specifically that I was deplatformed from a U.S. PATH committee as chair because of my affiliation with the Gender Dysphoria Alliance. That was U.S. PATH, the U.S. chapter of WPATH. So it's right within our community. So it definitely is happening. Aaron T., do you have anything to add to stuff about activism versus advocacy or just cultural shifts?
That was just really, I didn't know about that history that you just were discussing about that shift from the kind of more like anti-establishment, I guess, movements of the 60s and 70s. And, you know, obviously gay and lesbians just by virtue of being outsiders of the mainstream, you know, a part of that, and then intentionally to get more mainstream rights and whatnot. I didn't know about that. That's very, it's kind of interesting. I wonder if yeah, we can go similar route. But I think, so for us, it's all about separating this cultural moment of, yeah, which what can only be described as queer theory, this intention on, you know, yeah, dismantling everything that is, you know, kind of grounded in biological reality, and then and coupling that with gender dysphoria. It seems like so the trans movement right now is kind of reliant on two contradictory principles. One is that this is a neurological or psychological condition that is gender dysphoria that can be so terrible people will take their own lives if they don't get medical treatment for it. So that's a very severe, very serious mental health situation. And then the other facet is that all gender is bad, a construct, and we can basically dismantle it by queering our bodies, by transitioning, right? And so it's very much cosmetic and socio-political and not at all medical, but they rely on both of those things to justify whatever's needed in the moment based on the audience. I guess, yeah, I'm not sure I have anything to add about I mean, I never considered myself an activist, and still I'd say like the last 3 years or so, where I've been, you know, very vocal about what I see as medical negligence. Activism and advocacy is not something that I guess I just sort of accidentally found myself playing a role in just when I kind of got wind of all this.
Yeah.
So there's so many forms of activism, right? And not everybody has to be out on the streets beating the pavement day in and day out. There are writers, poets, songwriters. I mean, there are all various ways, filmmakers, where we can impart support, but awareness. Have any of you heard of, and I'm sure you have, Dean Spade?
Yeah, I'm vaguely familiar with him.
So somebody turned me on to his writing some years ago, and he is, I think, anti-establishment. He's an attorney, trans male, but he also works a lot within the movement of those who have been incarcerated. And so I think a lot of what he has perhaps seen, and I don't want to speak out of turn because he would actually be a very interesting guest to have on our show. He's probably seen a lot of failures with systems, and not just within the prison system, but the marriage constitution, where he feels it lies to people, it deceives people. So I was just curious if any of you had heard of Dean Spade.
Yeah, only shaking our head. Yes.
Yeah. Forget it. It's audio only. I need to stop gesturing.
He's out your way, by the way. He is in Washington.
Last I heard, he was teaching law in Washington State. That was a few years ago. I mean, everybody has a different experience in their life, and so our experiences can frame our understanding of things. And I think it's also possible, right, as a social worker, and maybe, you know, Aaron, you do mental health nursing. You know, as a mental health clinician, I know that it's possible to introduce alternative realities or experiences to people to dislodge them from their very fixed or rigid beliefs or thoughts about things based on their individual experience of what they've gone through, what they've seen other people go through. Because it's sort of like that, you know, putting a bunch of people around an elephant and telling them to close their eyes and describe an elephant, right? It's you're going to get a bunch of different descriptions of an elephant because it's coming from each of those individual vantage points or viewpoints. And I think that's what happens. And I don't begrudge anybody for the work they're doing to improve the lives of those who are incarcerated, those who have been hurt by marriage contracts. We all know that these things happen, but we also know that there are very loving. I've been married 21 years very happily. I don't consider it to be an obligatory contractual arrangement, even though it literally is, you know, as a state document. I served in the U.S. military, so I understand the concerns about the military-industrial complex. Martin Luther King Jr. used to talk about that. And I also am a veteran of the U.S. military. So I can understand these things. And my hope is that if we can get people to find more common ground and not necessarily change, people don't have to change what they believe or what they think, but to just know that there's some common ground and we might all be desiring a similar outcome, but how we're going to get there is very different based on these different philosophical viewpoints.
Mm-hmm. What you said there just, you know, made me think about just even the concept of assessment, you know, because I think people who have been assessed in the past before starting hormones or surgeries have maybe had very different experiences of that assessment process. I was assessed over about a 2 or 3 month period, and I found it helpful to just guide me through a thought process. And some of it I had already thought of, but there were questions asked that made me think of things I hadn't thought of. And I think it prepared me for this very complex process that I was about to enter into. Some people perhaps have had a very negative experience with assessment, because I've heard trans women in particular saying, like, unless this particular clinician felt like they would be turned on by them as a woman, they wouldn't want to transition them because they wouldn't pass adequately. So, I mean, I hear these stories, but we've done away.
That's infuriating to hear, actually.
It is very infuriating and inappropriate, but we've unfortunately have just done away with assessment altogether. So it reminds me of this elephant, right? I mean, so maybe they had an awful experience and other people, you know, were petting the tail, the nose and thought it was a very cute elephant, but we've done away with the entire elephant rather than looking at these individual experiences. Where was it helpful and went well? Where was it harmful and didn't go well? How do we integrate all of that knowledge into an assessment process that's going to be helpful for people rather than feeling as though assessment or psychotherapy across the board and an exploratory process is going to be harmful for everybody?
I remember some years ago, I was living in Jacksonville, Florida, and I had a completely different viewpoint after this experience with allies who claimed that they were all about the trans community, when in fact they were only interested in advancing what they knew would probably and most likely get advanced without too much work. And so what I would hear sitting around the city council were these comments, even from the gay community, that if we didn't have these beautiful representations or handsome representations, then they would just destroy any opportunity for this human rights ordinance to get passed. And that nauseated me, because some of the individuals who in one particular case did not pass, but but was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, was unfortunately one of these individuals who was perceived in this way. So I absolutely hear you.
Something like that, I think, happened in gay and lesbian activism, and that they tried so hard to mainstream and integrate into society at the expense of the outliers who are gender nonconforming and not as easily sellable to the mainstream. And I think that contributed to the motivation for a lot of very gender nonconforming gay and lesbian people to transition. It didn't leave us very much space to exist in if the mainstream gay and lesbian movement saw us as an embarrassment.
Aaron Kay, I was happy to hear that you shared a little bit about the assessment process that you went through. Aaron T, I'm wondering, what was the assessment process you went through before you were actually able to start hormones?
There was no assessment process. I told my general practitioner that I wanted to transition, and she said, because I didn't have any mental health comorbidities, you know, I seemed to know what I wanted and was, you know, completely mentally sound. So she said she would refer me to an endocrinologist who didn't require a therapist letter, meaning I wouldn't have to go through that. At the time, it was pretty universally required as just six months of therapy. And then at that time, you would get the referral letter to start hormones or get surgery. But I saw an endocrinologist who didn't require that letter, and I saw I went to a surgeon, didn't require any such letter either. So there was no assessment at all. This was, I think, at the very dawning of informed consent, I want to say. I'm not sure you guys, maybe Aaron Kay, you might have a better memory of the. Although I guess I'm from, you know, I transitioned to the U.S. Aaron Kay transitioned in Canada, so very different systems there, but. It was definitely under the informed consent model, where it's basically kind of like if you demonstrate that you understand various outcomes, side effects, and you know you're legally an adult and competent to consent, then there you go. So that was kind of, I think, the thought process at the time. Again, this was 2012. I got a diagnosis of transsexualism on the grounds that I wanted to transition, I guess. And that was about it, yeah.
We are taking our second break. We will be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We're back from our second commercial break. Our guests this hour are Aaron Kimberly and Aaron Terrell. We are discussing whether or not any of us were required to have a letter of recommendation before starting hormone replacement therapy, otherwise known by its acronym HRT. Let's pick up where we left off.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the DSM has gender dysphoria. But the ICD, or International Code of Disorders and Diseases, that the insurance companies use for for billing and reimbursement, they had transsexualism. So it's like two different systems. For me, in 2005, I went to a family medicine doctor. I got a prescription after one visit, had never seen her before, except in a public event where she talked about testosterone for 2 to 3 hours in front of a room of a bunch of people curious about testosterone at the public library in downtown San Francisco. And then I took that prescription to my doctor at the Department of Veterans Affairs at the outpatient clinic. And he walked it down the hallway to an endocrinologist, talked with that person for a little bit, came back and said, yeah, I'll put this prescription into the system. I never saw a mental health provider. Nobody ever did any assessment. I refused. I mean, I was pretty adamant back then that, I didn't want to be struck with the label of having what was called a gender identity disorder. I didn't like the idea of being labeled that way. I had spent my adolescence, about 3.5 years of my adolescence, in psychiatric institutions and group homes. And I was not going to be slapped with a label of some sort of disorder. And so I was very adamantly opposed to that. I was also 39 years old. Right. So let's be clear about I wasn't a child, nowhere near a child. So That's a difference. How about you? Did you ever go through an assessment?
I was out in California filming quite a bit, and I was seeing a counselor, but it wasn't really so much over that as it was just coming to terms with who I am. Actually, I started on hormones around 2005, 2006. That always floors people because I think they expect me to, and you know, I've talked about this before, Xander, have a beard and be really male presenting. And of course I'm not, because I've also proceeded very cautiously. While I'm more comfortable with what I'm doing, it's taken me a long time. Once I figured out I was very comfortable with who I am, and I've not veered from that. Do I feel that I could have benefited? Sure, because I think with mental health counseling, and I've been to therapists on and off throughout my life, some of it trauma related. I think the benefit of that is that we have different experiences along the way. And I think it's very important to acknowledge that and to recognize it when you're in the throes of it, because I don't think we always recognize it. So I think for that purpose, it's important. My question is, what does evidence-based look like to you?
What I've been advocating for is a systematic review of the evidence, which is considered, you know, in medical practice, the highest form of evidence, to have someone that's unbiased, who's skilled at just reviewing evidence and determining, because you can't really make a really solid conclusion based on one study. You have to look at the entire body of work that exists. And I mean, it's going to change as new research comes out, but someone has to review all the evidence that does exist, review it for the quality of the study, because there's a lot of garbage studies out there as well as some very well-designed studies. So someone skilled in doing that, that doesn't have a vested interest or a bias because they're not working in this field, they're not a trans person themselves, so they're not a consumer of the care, who can just review the evidence and tell us and help us guide clinical practice so we can design systems of practice based on our best quality evidence available, which should be done at certain intervals, right? So that new information is integrated into our practice and we can respond to that. But I fear that current practice has become so biased in the direction of the activism. And Aaron T used the word, the PR, that I feel PR, what is best for selling trans to the public, is interfering with clinical practice. The fact that clinicians don't understand what autogynephilia is. Like if I had a young person sitting in front of me and I suspected that's what was going on for them, I feel like they have a right to understand that and about themselves. So, because that is what true informed consent is.
So the trans healthcare, it's really up there and it's just going to keep increasing. And I think that's where we get lost. It's all about making money. And I've been in healthcare many, many years. And I've been in healthcare enough to know that there are very good people. And then there are people, it's all about money. It's not really about the individual and their well-being. We could see that with places like Tavistock. You know, maybe they had good intentions that perhaps they lost control over due to the fact that there was this pressure to see as many kids as possible. And I believe, from what I remember reading, some of these individuals weren't even properly trained. And I do believe we are seeing that and experiencing that even today in some of these settings.
Absolutely. And I really think that what happened at the Tavistock is happening at a much larger scale and a much worse scale in the US and Canada. So it's like we have the data from the Tavistock and everybody says it's so damning, but I'm like, this is quality. They're doing a good job relative to what's going on in North America. So we've yet to see what that's been looking like.
We are in the final moment of the show, final minutes. I'd love to hear from Aaron K and Aaron T. What's coming up for you?
Well, we continue to do the podcast. I have been engaging a lot of people within Canada in particular, engaging politicians, engaging clinicians. But we've also partnered with, and I'd love to plug this new initiative, the LGBT Courage Coalition, which is bringing together gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transsexuals together with concerns that we have. So our central focus is the medicalization of young people. We feel that because it's flown so far off of the rails, that a pause needs to be placed. There needs to, I really would like to see a pause button on medicalizing youth until we get a handle on this, because our fear is that far more youth are being harmed than are being helped by these clinicians that have gone rogue at the same time that so many young people seem to be opting into a trans identity.
Where can people find the LGBT Courage Coalition?
Snowstack. I don't know the URL. Yeah, we got a new post every day from a different a writer within the community. So yeah, we can, if there's show notes to link, we'll actually get the URL.
Yeah, we can get that up in the show notes. But for now, we'll let people know it's on Substack.com and it's LGBT Courage Coalition. Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show and talking to us about your own experiences and also the work that you're doing with the Gender Dysphoria Alliance. We always let our guests know that we'd love to have you back on sometime, so please keep that in mind. We might ask you to come back. We hope that you would accept that invitation. On any last words?
I very much so. I enjoyed this hour, and I appreciate your valuable insights and contribution. Thank you. It means a lot.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Yeah. We've obviously had Xander on our podcast, so you're certainly more than welcome. Okay. Love to hear your story.
There you go. That's Transparency. That's the name of the podcast.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks to you both.
We have come to the end of our hour. Our upcoming guest will be Felicia Miner. We hope that you will tune in again. Thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour.